In this hour of the show, we'll be getting the story of an invention that in many ways changed social life around the world. And as it did that, it also helped to establish a foundation for some rather big industries, including the automotive industry, the motorcycle industry, maybe even the aviation industry. It began as an effort to develop a kind of easily available, affordable transportation, in effect, a kind of a mechanical horse. By the turn of the century, it was one of the biggest industries in America and probably around the world, continues to be the biggest, most common source of affordable transportation. And we're talking about the bicycle. Our guest for the program this morning is David Herlihy. He is an historian and writer, freelance writer, who is the author of a recently published book that's titled Bicycle, the History, and it's published by the Yale University Press. It's a really lovely book, has a lot of photographs and illustrations. If you are a bicycle enthusiast, or you know someone who is, or perhaps someone who is just fascinated with machines and how they develop, I think that you would find this book really fascinating. It came out just the 1st of November, so certainly should be in bookstore if you want to look at it. I'm going to tell you just a little bit more about our guest, David Herlihy. He's been interested in bicycle technology for quite a while, ever since his days as a member of the Harvard Cycling Club, and for the past 10 years he's been doing research on the invention and the early development of the bicycle. His work has been featured on National Public Radio, Voice of America, and also in the New York Times, the Boston Globe, Boston Magazine, and also Historic Preservation. In 1999, he received the McNair History Award from the Wheelmen. That's the preeminent American Association of Antique Bicycle Collectors. And he is joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. And we do also have a toll-free line. And so if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455, and toll-free anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Mr. Herlihy, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
It was my pleasure.
It's a very, very interesting book. It's a lot of fun, and as I say, it has a lot of wonderful photographs and illustrations, and it traces the development of this device pretty thoroughly. You know what? I think it's interesting that certainly we know that there are today a lot of very serious cyclists. There are people who race, and there are people who do off-road cycling, and it's also, you know, it's possible to spend a lot of money on a bicycle, and that there are bicycles today that are very sophisticated technologically in terms of their materials they're made out of and so forth. But having said all that, I think probably in a lot of people's minds, the bicycle remains a toy, something for children, and it's good probably to be reminded just how important a source of transportation the bicycle was and perhaps still is, and how much force this put behind the drive to develop the bicycle from its beginnings to the form that we know now.
Oh, I completely agree. I think really the original dream of the bicycle was for a practical machine, and that is still its primary function, certainly in the developing world. There's really no more efficient way to get around, and I see in quite a few cities that I visit, especially in Europe, they're combing with bicycles in some city centers where traffic's been limited. So if it continues to serve that kind of, maybe we tend to overlook that, but it truly is a great transportation resource.
Anybody have any idea how many bicycles there are in the world today?
I think I put the figure close to some. Oh, did I say a billion? I think that's about what I said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really a stunning number when you think about it.
Oh, it is. I mean, when you consider how pricey and few the very first machines were back in the 1860s, it's quite a remarkable development.
Yeah. The book traces the development of the bicycle and how relatively quickly early on the features that we've come to know That is the wheel with the spokes, the rubber tire, the inner tube, the kind of braking and gearing systems we have. If you go back to the very, very beginning, you look at the precursors to the bicycle, there was a period where there was this thing. And, you know, if you'd look at it today, and there are photographs of these things, and there are lots of illustrations of people riding them, you'd look at this thing and say, well, I know what that is. It looks like a bicycle that's got two wheels in line. It's got a place to sit, and it's got handlebars. And yet in some important respects, it's not like the bicycle we know. Maybe the biggest one is that you look at it, and if you look at it long enough, you realize this thing has no pedals. And then you wonder, well, how exactly was this propelled? This was the thing that comes first, the velocipede. Let's talk about that. Who came up with this idea?
Well, that was a German baron, Karl von Drais, who was a very creative thinker, and he had really all sorts of projects going on, but he was keenly interested in one problem that had been around for a while, actually, which was this problem of the mechanical horse, how to create something that might be more efficient than walking. And there was a great deal of controversy from the start, uncertainty whether that was really even possible. A certain one school of thought held that that there was no possibility to improve on the God-given means of walking, and certainly Drais rejected that, and he began early in around 1804, I think it was, he was trying to create some kind of four-wheeler that two or three people could propel with some kind of mechanical drive. And at some point, he seems to have come to the conclusion that, in fact, mechanical drives were never going to be efficient, but he still had an idea of a way he thought would improve on the natural means of walking, which was not really to supplant that, but to accelerate it. So his idea was something called an aid to walking, which was this machine that you described, which was the original two-wheeler. And it was certainly a very novel approach. But I think, you know, our tendency when we look at that today is to think, wow, that's a bicycle without pedals.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to understand that there really is a conceptual difference there, and that what Drais is trying to do is get away from any kind of mechanical drive because he doesn't believe that they're efficient. So the whole idea is that this contraption works with the natural means of walking and accelerates it just because in between your strides, if you're the rider, you're going to be moving along, whereas you wouldn't be without this thing. So, and he also, Drais argues that it helps support your weight, so it's less pressure on the feet. So that was kind of the whole concept behind that original two-wheeler to be an aid to walking.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at this thing, and one of the things that you realize when you see it is that the wheels on this look very much like the wheels on a carriage.
Mm-hmm.
You look at it and you have to imagine this might have been a kind of a rough ride.
Well, it certainly was. In fact, they were basically miniature carriage wheels. The first two-wheelers and human-powered vehicles were all built using existing carriage technology, which included wooden spoked wheels with an iron tire going around them. So, and of course, you're talking about frames that are either wood or, in some cases, solid iron. So, the whole you're not at a point where you have smooth bearings, ball bearings, or so. It's heavy. It's rickety. But I think the real challenge was to come up with a basic plan for a human-powered vehicle that was convincing enough to invite technical improvements. And really, that was the struggle that it endured for decades, just trying to come up with that basic plan. And in fact, inventors prematurely rejected, after some experimentation around 1819, in Europe and the United States even, inventors came to the conclusion that the aid to walking with the two wheels didn't, in fact, work, and so they began to revert to other older plans, which involved three or four wheels and mechanical drives. So that for a long time was really the stumbling block. What what's the basic form? I mean, obviously the two-wheeler from the very beginning held a certain appeal because it really minimized the materials involved, and it had this kind of compact form. Mm-hmm. So it was appealing, but as far as anyone could see, the only use a two-wheeler could have was in this context of an aid to walking, something you would straddle and kick along. And so once the consensus arose that just wasn't, in fact, a practical way, as far as anyone could see, the two-wheeler was a dead end. And so, unfortunately, that was obviously, in retrospect, a missed opportunity.
We have a caller here who's been waiting patiently. We want to get to them. Others, of course, people who have questions, they're welcome to call. I'll also introduce again our guest. We're talking this morning with historian, freelance writer David Herlihy about the book that looks at the development of the bicycle. And the title of his book is Bicycle, the History. It's published by the Yale University Press. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. We have a caller on a cell phone. Calling in on our toll-free line right here. Hello.
Hello. How you doing, guys?
Good.
Good. Now, I have a question about bicycles. What kind of value could bicycles hold, like the antiques, and is there really much out there for them or not really?
Oh, I think there's a lot of value. In fact, there's an annual auction in a small town called Copaic, New York, in the spring, which has been growing every year, and I've seen bicycles from various eras fetch, I believe, as high as $20,000, maybe more.
Oh, wow.
You know, it really depends. Obviously, if you happen to have, I mean, these kick-propelled machines that we were talking about are extremely rare and basically not on the market because so few were made. But starting with the bone shaker era in the 1860s, when something like 20,000 machines were made in this country, there's still a few kicking around. And, you know, depending on whether they have a label identifying the manufacturer, how interesting they are, how rare, they could be worth quite a bit of money. And then, of course, there's the high wheelers of the 1880s are very much a prized machine. There's collector groups. Some people ride replicas. There's a few firms that make replicas of these. But there's some who, you know, prefer to ride around the real thing. And those can fetch a lot of money as well. But more recently, of course, there's also the whole boom era, the 1890s. There were millions of bikes made then. And those, depending on what, those may or may not hold a huge value. But more recently, some of the children's bicycles from, say, the so-called fat tire machines from the 30s, the 40s, or even after the war, the Schwinn-type bikes, some of those can fetch a lot of money, depending on what kind of condition they're in. And, I mean, there are entire clubs that are dedicated specifically to those machines. So, yeah, I think if you've got something in your barn or attic, you might want to take a look at it.
So I have, like, a two-seater that I've been having sitting around for many years, and it's a pretty old bike. And how do I go about checking on that?
Well, I would suggest contacting the Copaic auction people.
Mm-hmm.
I think it actually is www.copaicauction.com.
Copaic auction, okay.
And,
I can do that.
Because they will certainly give you a sense of what they think it would fetch. That would be a good place to start.
Okay.
All right. Well,
thank you for your time.
Okay.
Sure.
Thanks
Bye-bye.
For the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Well, we talked a little bit about this precursor to the bicycle, this vehicle that it's a two-wheeler, the wheels in line. You look at it, you think, well, okay, I know what that is. It's a bicycle. But that it was propelled basically by the rider sitting on it, straddling it, and then putting his feet down on the ground and kicking off the way you would do on a skateboard, essentially. And then you could coast, but then you'd have to periodically continue to do this. The first bicycle, though, the first true bicycle came when someone got the idea of putting pedals on the front wheel, directly on the wheel, like the tricycles that we all grew up with. And this happened in France. Who was it that came up with that idea? Or do we know, was there, in fact, an individual who gets credit for this idea of, hey, why don't we take some pedals and we'd stick them on the front wheel and that's the way we'll propel it?
Right. Well, you know, the question of where that idea, which you know, to us from our vantage point would seem sort of like a no-brainer, but you know, where that actually originates, there is some controversy. And in fact, during the great bicycle boom in the 1890s, quite a few priority claims emerged, and it was generally accepted that sometime in the 1840s, a handful of Scottish blacksmiths, or at least one in particular, Kirkpatrick Macmillan, came up with some kind of two-wheeler with, if not what we would call rotary pedals, supposedly had some sort of treadle drive, which is actually somewhat surprising in that arguably that's a more advanced design because it's a rear-wheel design and that has certain advantages. But whether or not that was actually produced is really still a controversy. And in fact, I address that to some extent in the book, and I really, after examining a lot of period evidence in Scotland, I came away unconvinced. I'm suspicious that that was some sort of that basically what Macmillan and others at the time in the 1840s built were three-wheelers, and that at a certain point, 50 years later, I believe there was some embellishment there during the Great Boom to claim priority. But I think what we can reasonably conclude is that the point where the bicycle proper, meaning a two-wheeler with pedals, appears in the market is definitely in France, and it's mid-1860s, let's say. I mean, the actual marketing starts in the year 1867 in Paris by a firm called Michaud. But even in that whole phenomenon is somewhat controversial because it's not quite clear how this mark Michaud or this make Michaud materializes and basically who was behind it. I mean, I guess it kind of comes down to the question of was this really a breakthrough idea or was the idea of a bicycle kicking around for a long time and it was just sort of awaiting the right marketing circumstances. And I think conventional thinking often holds, I think in part sort of influenced by these various claims of Scottish blacksmiths and so forth, conventional thinking I think tends to hold that, well, it was such an obvious idea to add pedals that the idea must have been kicking around, so we don't really need to be thinking about a real invention here. But that, again, that's I actually reject that because I think that going back to the Dresden, it really didn't establish the principle of the bicycle, in spite of the fact that as we look back and we consider a two-wheeler coasting downhill, a two-wheeler without pedals, in effect, that's emulating a bicycle as we know it. It's basically tantamount to, you know, getting on a bicycle and coasting down on your bike. I mean, you're basically proving, or, you know, that's the principle of the bike, the fact that it is possible to propel a two-wheeler. But I think what wasn't necessarily appreciated back in around 1819 with this kick-propelled machine was that it was possible to sustain the balancing act, that it wasn't just a phenomenon of gravity working with you, that there was a way to come up to actually add a drive and propel the thing. So I think that discovery really was the key. I mean, that had to be made. And so, in effect, the question is, who makes that discovery and brings it into the public domain to the point where suddenly it's obvious that, hey, you know, that's the way to build two-wheelers, and this is something we can build on. And, again, there is controversy surrounding that. It's clearly, the backdrop is definitely Paris in the early 1860s, and the whole thing sort of revolves around three characters, shall we say. One is a workman named Pierre Lallemand, who's something like 20 years of age, and he's in the he's built small vehicles for children, and he's the fellow who eventually migrates to the United States in the year 1865 and takes out the first patent that actually defines this principle of the bicycle. And then you've got Michaud the blacksmith, who is the fellow who oversees production of these things a few years after Lallemand leaves, when the first commercial models appear around 1867. And then the third party, which has been kind of sort of lurking behind all this, the couple of brothers who were engineering students, also quite young, named the Oliviers. And they, it appears, were really the driving force behind that Michaud company. And it's not clear. I mean, the early advertisements in France, in Paris, presented Michaud and even falsely claimed that he had a patent as the original inventor. But I really think that the Olivier brothers were, in some sense, sort of propping up Michaud. And undoubtedly, there was some kind of interaction between this fellow Lallemand, who leaves Paris in 65, and Michaud and Lallemand, and the Oliviers, and this whole... So it's a bit involved, but it's clearly that there's some kind of there's something brewing here. I mean, there's a basic idea, there's excitement, there's already ideas on how to improve this basic model. I mean, what's curious is that although the Lallemand patent, the bicycle depicted in Lallemand patent, filed in the U.S. in 1866, is virtually identical to the machines that the bicycles that first appear about a year later in Paris. The Parisian models had certain improvements not in Lallemand's patent, such as brakes. So something gets started, and the idea is crystallizing. And I think it's very exciting to many people who really had long ago dismissed the whole, mechanical horse as kind of a wild goose chase. There's even though it's not absolutely clear that this thing is going to be useful, because remember, it still is quite crudely constructed. It's something like 70 pounds. I mean, it has none of these refinements. And yet, I think that basic discovery of the principle of the bicycle was very exciting and truly did open up a whole new path for development.
We have another caller here, someone who is also on cell phone. We'll get right to them. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. I'd like to ask the question to the answer. The first one is, when I was a kid, I used to have a bicycle that had big balloon tires, mm-hmm. and it had what they called the rear, I don't know what it was, a kickstand, but you could put the whole rear wheel off the ground. So mm-hmm. if you wanted, you could just sit there and pedal. And I remember on one of my birthdays, I was given a regular fancy bicycle with thin tires, and I kept getting flats on those, and I never got on the big tires, and I was kind of wondering why that switch occurred. The two other are, one, is the recumbent bicycle an old or a new idea, and is it a good idea? I know there's a problem that you get run over because nobody can see you, you're so low to the ground. But people tell me that it gives relief to your back. And the third question is, I've been seeing a lot of advertisements and catalogs for automatic transmission bicycles, and basically that shift automatically. And from your knowledge, are those sound? Do they work, or you really need to be able to control everything manually? I'll just hang up and listen to the answers. Thank you.
Right. Well, the caller has given us enough to do the whole rest of the show, probably, if not a while longer. Maybe we start with tires, as that was kind of the next thing that I was thinking about asking about. If we talked about the fact that the sort of the first important development in the history of the bicycle was whoever it was who decided to stick the pedals on the wheel and use that to drive it. Well, if you look at the early prototypes of those, like the things that came before, they still look like they've got carriage wheels on them. So at some point, though, someone comes up with the idea of the wheel, bicycle wheel, kind of as we know it, that has spokes, and then also that has tires, that have rubber tires. And, of course, there are various kinds of them. There are the great big balloon tires that some of us grew up with as kids. And then on racing bicycles, of course, they have really little narrow tires, and off-road bicycles they have sometimes bigger kind of nubby tires. Maybe you could just talk about those things.
Right. Well, yeah. What's interesting about getting back to this idea that the sort of basic bicycle appearing in 1867 in Paris is within about 3 years you see. There's so much interest. I mean, it's sort of this worldwide craze, and there's so many improvements that come in rapid succession. For example, a key development which took place really in England, France, and the United States was the replacement of those carriage wheels with wire wheels, so very lightweight suspension wheels that absorbed a lot of the road shock. And another improvement was to use a strip of a solid rubber tire, basically. And that also, combined with the wire wheels, made, even by the early 1870s, some fairly roadworthy machines. And tire technology really didn't evolve a whole lot after that for some time, because with the development of the high wheeler in the 1870s, 1880s, that was the most popular bicycle form. The tires used then were solid rubber tires, obviously larger ones. They had to accommodate the wheel, but there was a certain amount of technology involved as far as how to fix the tires. But for a long time, and even with the introduction of the very first, what we call the safety bicycles in the late 1880s, which was pretty much developed in England, you still have solid rubber tires. So the big breakthrough in tires occurs in the late 1880s, and that's the pneumatic tire. And that's credited to John Dunlop, who was an Irishman actually living in Scotland, or rather a Scotsman living in Ireland. And, you know, with a rapid succession, again, of a development there, including the Michelin brothers in France, who get, before too long, reasonably efficient clincher tires, that is, tires that are practical enough that, they're inflatable, but you can also remove the inner tube, and because repairing was one of the major problems. I mean, it was pretty clear right from the beginning when Dunlop introduced the pneumatic that it offered great advantages in comfort and speed. And it was a bit of a challenge to come up with a system that would actually be practical, something that you wouldn't have to, if you had a flat, you wouldn't have to send it back to the factory. And in fact, the whole development of that pneumatic tire was a huge, was very much part of the great bicycle boom in the 1890s, and maybe even a prerequisite. The boom really takes off after that technology becomes reasonably available. As far as the use of it, whether you want a fat tire or a thin tire, the fat tire, the balloon tire, was, I think it was actually developed in Europe in the 1920s, maybe with an interest in tourism, but in this country anyway, it hits the market on children's bicycles, probably about the 20s and 30s. And I think the reasoning was, as the caller was sort of describing, the frustration of when he tried to switch to thin tires and suffered, flat. One of the advantages in using these balloon tires, the fat tires on kids' bikes, was that they were pretty robust. I mean, kids could, as they're prone to do, they could, jump curb stones and so forth without having to, suffering a flat tire and being grounded and so forth. So, that flat tire was, or the fat tire was also used in later on with the advent of mountain bikes, with the introduction in the 1970s and 80s, for the same reason. And more recently, you see, if not truly fat tires, certainly relatively wide tires being used on city bikes too, for the same reason that they tend to be a little more robust, and so they offer certain advantages. But I think the thin tire technology, which of course has always been popular with racers, initially racers would use what were known as tubular tires, so basically sew-ups. I mean, you had the casing was stitched together at the base and glued to the rim, and for a long time that was really the only sort of serious competitive tire. And of course, that was, I remember using them back in the 70s, and flats were were annoying. I mean, you could certainly, if you had a spare, repair it, or if you were truly ambitious, you could open it up and do your own fixing. But fortunately, I think more recent years, you see the development of very, very effective thin tires that are clincher tires. So they offer at least the advantages in terms of ease of repair that the fat tire does, and yet they're very, very efficient. So, yeah, tire technology is very, very interesting, important part of bicycling. And I guess you want me to move on to the recumbent?
Well, because I think one of the things that you explain in the book is that the basic features of the bicycle as we know it today, with the kind of wheels they have, with the kind of brakes we have, with the kind of gearing, those developments occurred relatively early in the history of the bike. And the big differences between those bicycles and the ones we have now probably are the materials out of which they're made, particularly the things that we make the frames out of. But basically, the way that you ride it, the position that you ride in, that's been pretty much the same. Now, the major departure is this style of bicycle that's called the recumbent, which I don't know, there are probably some people who are big advocates of the recumbent because they feel that in terms of the ergonomics of it, that it's actually a much more efficient design, but you don't see them very much. Although this is one of those things that if you ask this question, well, what could you imagine as a very dramatic kind of different approach to the design of a bicycle? That seems to be it. What sort of, do you think that there is particularly a future for the recumbent as a kind of a mass marketed kind of product?
Well, that is an interesting question, and as you say, I think it probably is the biggest question one can ask about the future of the bike. To answer the caller's question, the recumbent is, in fact, actually an old idea. In fact, you can even go back to the Bone Shaker period, and there was one American model that was designed to put the rider in a more reclined position to get better leverage on the pedals. But during the great boom, when a lot of inventors were looking for the next great breakthrough, there were several recumbent, or what we might call semi-recumbent, because there's some variation. I mean, you can be either, as in some of these racing models, completely stretched out, or you could be sort of in a semi-recumbent position, which is considered, I think, the preferred method, or at least the more practical one. You know, so in the boom they were proposed, but they failed to catch on. And in France in the 20s and 30s, there was something of a revival in the racing scene because a number of racers, you had these attempts to set records for the hour. The hour was kind of a prized mark. And a number of racers came to the conclusion that if they built a bike that was reclined, that would actually go faster thanks to it. I guess it's a combination of the pressure that you can apply to the pedals and also just the fact that you're a lot more aerodynamic. But, of course, that sparked a controversy, and the establishment, the racing establishment, after kind of being shocked at the sudden flurry of records, some of which were set by people, middle-aged people, against standard bicycles, they knew they had to do something, and they decided that they would just ban them, that was not a recumbent, was not a real bicycle. And that's still a point that, a very, very much a sore point with a lot of the proponents of this design. As, what is its future? I think it's hard to say. I think that as a practical vehicle, as a city bike, I don't think they are going to supplant the conventional bike just because I think that they're clearly, I mean, there's questions of safety. The caller pointed out you're a lot lower, so if you're worried, I mean, obviously you can compensate for that by putting some kind of flag or something. But the fact is you're going to be lower, and some people would not feel so safe. Also, I mean, they're just going to be, with the longer wheelbase, less practical machine for storage, probably not so easy to corner with. So far, I think a variety of reasons it's not likely to really supplant conventional bike as a city machine. But, you know, I think where the potential might be would be in the recreational market because I'm told anyway that recumbents can be a lot are purportedly a lot more comfortable. Some people say that a lot less strain on your back. And, of course, they are more efficient. So, in theory, they could be compelling as if you're interested in going out on long bike rides in the countryside. It's not clear to me anyway, about hills, whether I think arguably the conventional bicycle has certain advantages in getting up a hill because you can stand up and kind of work your way over. Again, I am probably touching already on some some issues that proponents might differ with, but I certainly think that there might be a potential for some kind of semi-recumbent bike as a recreational machine.
Yeah, it is true that was it someone in a recumbent bicycle set the record for speed in a human-powered vehicle mm-hmm. with one of these? It was 80 or more,
yes.
More than 80 miles an hour?
I think just over 80. Yes, as incredible as that sounds. This going back to the 1970s, the International Human-Powered Vehicle Association was founded, and in part because a lot of technically minded bicycle lovers felt that this whole path for development with the recumbent had been wrongly blocked off, basically, by this decision to ban them from racing, from organized racing. So they decided to, a bunch of engineers, create this association, and they've held annual events, annual races. They've offered prizes. In part, I think part of their interest is, in fact, to develop maybe some kind of practical bicycle that might, say, have some kind of shell around it to protect you from weather. So, I mean, I think they envisioned the recumbent answering all the needs of a bicycle, but certainly one way, I mean, its natural advantage is in speed, and that's something that they wanted to illustrate by holding these races. And, I think it was 2 years ago in Nevada, I believe, at one of the annual races, a fellow eclipsed 80 miles an hour, if you can believe it. I have a picture in the book. I mean, he's totally, he's obviously lying down. I think he can either be face down or face up. I think he's actually face up, so you can actually see there's actually a spot where his transparent shell, part of the shell where you can actually see his head. But I think everybody knows that this is not a practical design for city use, but it's certainly, I think what they're trying to show, though, is just how much more efficient recumbents can be versus the conventional design.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and I want to again introduce the guest, David Herlihy. He's an historian and freelance writer. He's been interested in bicycle technology for a long time and spent, roughly speaking, the last decade researching the invention and early development of the bicycle. And the result is his book, Bicycle, A History, or The History, and it's published by the Yale University Press. It's a very nice book, has fascinating text and a lot of photographs and illustrations. So if you're an enthusiast or if you know someone who is, it would be a great book for them. We have some other people who would like to talk with us. Let's go back to the phones and Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes, I own a recumbent and I do feel more vulnerable in traffic because your profile's lower and the cars look bigger and it's harder to get off one of those things as opposed to conventional bike. It is relaxing in that you've got your feet up like you're sitting at home, and you've got your feet up reading a book, watching television. But as Mr. Hurley, he said, if you try and go up a hill, forget it, because you cannot stand up and put pressure on the pedals to get up the hill. I was wondering if your guest had any idea about tubeless tires. I've ridden on a flat before on a well-studded tire, And I could have sworn I had some air in it. And then when I came back, I realized I didn't even have any air in it. But it's really an inconvenience to have a flat tire. And I'm wondering if there's any manufacturer that makes if not a solid rubber tire, an almost a solid rubber tire with possibly air pockets or an airstream in it.
You know, I wish that's like a little bit maybe too contemporary for me to almost like the other caller. I didn't answer his question about the automatic transmissions. I think those are two examples of, you know, conceivably innovative technology that mm-hmm. might yet find a market niche. I honestly couldn't tell you,
uh-huh.
you know, how useful. Or I know that the idea of a airless tire has been around for a while. Whether there's any truly practical designs out there, I honestly have to plead ignorance on that.
Yeah, I'll search on the web for it, perhaps.
Yeah. It's certainly possible that there are. You know, I agree. I mean, flats are a hassle. There's no doubt about it. And you know, it may be time to. There may be time for another radical innovation in tire tech or even gearing technology.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
All right,
okay.
Thank you. Thanks. Let's go to another Urbana caller. This is line two. Hello.
Hi. I'm calling to advocate for recumbent bikes. I know you probably thought you'd get a call like this. But, I don't ride my bike around town very much, partly because it's just such an expensive bike. I don't want to risk having it stolen, which is unfortunate that they're so expensive. But for long-distance touring, I don't think I would take any other bike but a recumbent bike. And, I don't think the comfort thing can be emphasized enough because a lot of people get nerve damage in their arms and wrists because of regular upright bikes and the neck and back problems. And then I think the most important is the seat because I think for women it's really difficult to design a seat that's comfortable for long-distance riding on an upright bike. And on recumbent bikes, the seat is much better. And in terms of hills, I think it depends on which model of recumbent bike you get. Some are better at hills than others, and it has to do with the angle that your legs are at and how efficient it gets kind of technical. But if you just gear down, you can go up any hill. I've been together where I had to get off and rock. So they are really great for long distance. And I heard that that some companies have developed a mountain bike, a recumbent mountain bike that is sort of a hybrid between a mountain and a recumbent, because part of the problem with recumbents is you really can't go off-road or even on gravel because of the stability issues.
Mm-hmm.
But,
yeah, I think you've identified what I think is the most promising market, which is the recreational use, and maybe even, I could perhaps imagine older riders maybe starting to gravitate towards the recumbent just because of its advantages with comfort. And so, yeah,
even younger male riders concerned about prostate trouble. I mean, I think that upright bikes, the seats are upright. Recumbent riders call upright bikes wedgies. Like that's
right. Yeah, I know that. It's funny because my book, I mentioned a doctor in 1869 when the first philosophy came out already was concerned about, there's some line about how, about the future bicyclists, the children or the lack of children of future bicyclists or something like that. I mean, it's been a concern for a long time, the question of whether, the seat might cause long-term damage. Genitals. I think that was back in the news actually pretty recently. I think the answer is you probably have to ride an awful lot though before you have to worry about that health risk. But there's certainly a case to be made for recumbents, I think, overall.
Yeah, I mean, around town you probably want a cheap upright bike that you don't really care about, but for long distance touring, I don't think they can be compared. And also, I mean, the safety thing, I have lots of slabs on mine, and it's so weird looking that it kind of stands out from other vehicles. And so I think I'm pretty visible because I'm kind of odd looking. And it certainly starts a lot of conversations when you're on tour.
Yeah.
Well, it is. I think, as Dave was saying, certainly the probably, I mean, it's clearly recumbents is certainly the most radical proposal that still warrants a lot of interest. And it's difficult to know whether, I mean, maybe they'll peacefully coexist, it seems to me. I mean, I'm not expecting that conventional bicycle will ever be completely surpassed, but you never know.
Yeah, I don't think it will, and recumbents are so expensive right now that they're really for the serious enthusiasts.
Right, although the market kind of has a way of, I mean, if you look even with the first safety bicycles were pretty outrageously expensive. So, I mean, part of that is just economics. You know, if there's a groundswell demand, you could expect to see the price come down. So, who knows? I mean, it's really hard to know what the future holds.
All right. Well, thank you. Real quick, I guess we want to try to get back to our caller in Bloomington, I think, on line number 4. Hello.
Yes. Hello.
Oh, yeah. This is another caller in Bloomington. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was 4. Disconnected, and now I'm 4 again.
Well, my apologies. Go ahead.
No, that's fine. Nothing so glamorous as recumbent bikes. I found a little bike. It's actually a two-wheeler in a junk shop, and I haven't any idea what I've got. It's called Angeles, A-N-G-E-L-E-S. It's really small. It is two wheels. The front wheel is a little bigger than the back wheel. It almost is like a clown bike.
Mm-hmm.
Real heavy,
mm-hmm.
Very heavy, heavy. Red plastic on the pedals, the grips, and the seat. There's no cushioning. It's like direct. And the pedals are directly on the front wheel. It's about 16 inches the seat is from the ground. It's almost so heavy that a child who might pedal something like this, I wouldn't think, could handle it. And
Well, it's certainly, it's not inconceivable that it is some kind of circus bike. I mean, bicycles have been part of circus acts from the beginning, really. In fact, a good friend of mine, an Australian acrobat, and his act involves riding a bike that is literally 6 inches off the ground. And
yes, this could probably handle somebody 300 pounds.
Well, maybe it's an elephant. Maybe it's designed for an elephant.
Maybe it's a what?
Designed to have an elephant pedal. You never. I mean, I've seen pictures of bears on bicycles. I'm only guessing here, but
it's a very strange little thing, which is why I bought it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wanted to give it to our real bikers in the family who are triathletes.
Mm.
Put it in the Christmas drawing and see what kind of reaction I got. But if I knew something about it, I'd like to know something about it. But nobody seems to know anything.
Well, I'd go back to my advice maybe at contacting the Copec auction people, because I think they've seen just about everything that's out there. And, mm-hmm. You know, if you sent them a photo, I'm sure that would help them identify it for you.
Okay. So you've never seen anything quite?
I mean, it sounds like it could have been, you know, an inexpensive child cycle. But, I mean, it's possible that it has some kind of specialty use, like in a circus. I mean, it's certainly not out of the realm of possibilities.
Okay. It's just a little bizarre, but it does have a logo. I mean, it almost looks homemade, but it does have a welded logo to it.
Well, that'll certainly help. I'm sure identifying if you know the city where it's made and the make should certainly. I mean, somebody out there is going to recognize it, I think. I mean, of course, you know, there's hundreds of makes over the years, but this sounds like it must have been some sort of specialty bicycle of some sort.
Right, and the seat is cast plastic, and it has the logo name in the back edge of the seat, so it's,
yeah,
not like it's not like a homemade piece. It's actually manufactured.
Hmm. And the other thing is sometimes, you know, it's all to be sometimes careful about trying to date a cycle based on the parts, because you never know what might have been replaced over the years. So I think you really want to try to photograph the whole thing and send that along, and hopefully they can identify it for you.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, thanks. Can you give us the spelling of the name of this auction?
Oh, sure. It's Copake.
Okay, very good.
Opaque New York. It's a fun event. If I believe it's early April. I mean, quite a few collectors from around the country come to it, and it's not just bikes. I mean, there's a lot of, as you can imagine, of bike-related stuff out there, board games, you name it, books, magazines. I mean, it's really just about anything that's connected to cycling history.
Yeah, very good. I'm finally finding that. I was looking before on my computer here on the website, and I was trying all the different ways I could think of spelling it, and that what C-O-P-A-K-E was not one of them. But now I have indeed found it in Copaque, New York. They do have a website.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, there's so many things that we could talk about that we haven't really quite gotten to. One of the things I thought was really fascinating, if people think about old bicycles, they may well think of the high wheel or the big wheel bike, the one with the enormous front wheel. And I guess one of the things that I learned from reading the book that I hadn't realized was that these bicycles were built for racing. Which is
kind
of hard to imagine.
There were different models, even though the basic profile looked the same. Some of those high wheelers were built for touring, some for racing. The racing machines were incredibly light, as light as I think 20 pounds or even less in some cases, some of the latter models. And that's in part because variations in the tubing. But one thing about the high wheeler, despite its enormous profile, is it doesn't have the gear that goes along with the safety, which is one reason why some people at the time thought it would always prevail, just because it is such a simple design, direct drive. They are actually quite light machines and very well built, and they can go pretty fast. I mean, the big drawback was the propensity to be catapulted over the handlebars, the safety issue.
One can imagine it would have been a pretty uncomfortable experience. Well, we're going to have to stop, I'm sorry to say, but for people who love bicycles, who are interested in their development, again, I suggest look for the book. It's titled Bicycle History, and by our guest, David Herlihy, and it's published by the Yale University Press. And David, thanks very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.